In the name of the Holy Trinity, one God. Amen. Six days later, our gospel begins today. 6 days after what? You might wonder. For 2 weeks, we've been reading passages out of this same gospel. We've heard Matthew's telling of the Sermon on the Mount. Rachel, our seminarian, who extends her regrets for not being here today, in her preaching, she walked us through Jesus' teaching of the law. Jesus giving us a recipe for discipleship. Jesus wants us to follow him and wants us to follow not the letter of the law, he said, but the heart of the law. Today's gospel passage doesn't follow on the heels of these passages. It's not 6 days after the Sermon on the Mount. Our lectionary has skipped ahead. 6 days later is actually 12 chapters later in Matthew, and much has happened in the meantime. But as we're ending the season of Epiphany and entering Lent in 3 days, we must push on. We'll come back to these chapters later, don't you worry. 6 days later begins the dramatic turn in Jesus and his followers' lives. Peter and the rest of the disciples have just spent time with Jesus in Caesarea Philippi. It's a resting place away from the crowds. Caesarea Philippi is a lush green place north of the Sea of Galilee, where the waters flow freely along walking paths and there are lovely gardens. It is there that Peter answers Jesus' question, "Who do people say that I am?" "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God," Peter says, and Jesus affirms him, calls him the rock on which God will build his church. Then Jesus tells his followers, "Now we must go on to Jerusalem, where I must die." And Peter argues back, "No," he says, "God forbid." Jesus says to Peter, "Don't be a blockhead." "Well, really," he says, "Peter, you're a stumbling block. You are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." And 6 days later, they have a divine experience. Jesus takes Peter, James, and John to a high mountain. And what occurs there is something unexplainable. Unearthly, if you will. Jesus is transfigured. His clothes become dazzling white. Two figures appear, Moses and Elijah, the great ones of their faith. Moses is the giver of the law, who himself faced God on a mountain and came down with a face shining so brightly the Israelites were afraid of him. And Elijah, the great prophet who God sent to the Israelites to deliver them from their suffering and the oppression of the king, and who at the end of his life was taken up to heaven in a whirlwind, mystifyingly. Peter is elated at first. We see our lovable disciples' excitement at this, and he proposes his idea, "Let's build 3 shelters, 3 dwellings. One for Moses, one for Elijah, and one for you, Jesus, because you're surely as great as these great men of our faith." Sweet Peter, 6 days earlier, he just called Jesus the Messiah, and yet now we see that he didn't quite get what he was saying. Peter didn't even know how confused he was. "Let's stay here on the mountain. See, it's like I suggested before, Jesus, we don't have to go to Jerusalem." I'm pretty sure I would be on Peter's side here, wanting to save Jesus and maybe myself from what was to come. And like the disciples, I'm sure I would have fallen face to the ground, terrified, when I heard a voice from the cloud saying, "This is my son, listen to him." The encounter on the mountain is frightening and bewildering. The cloud that shadows the disciples and Jesus is so bright. The disciples are overwhelmed. They're overcome by fear. Then, as quickly as the vision and the cloud had come, it is gone. Jesus comes to his scared friends and touches them and says, "Get up. Do not be afraid." The disciples' mountaintop experience is over. Jesus has been transfigured before them, and they're not sure what happened. They were both terrified and comforted, both blinded by the light and sure that they saw something special. For the disciples, the transfiguration was a mystical experience. It was ethereal, as if time meant nothing or was non-existent. This moment enabled the disciples to face many directions at once, back to God's calling, God's people through the law and the prophets, to the present now. Imagine the joy and apprehension you might feel, comprehending that you're in the presence of God. And they finally realized Jesus' true identity. In this experience, they were pulled forward as well to see the hope of humankind in the person of Jesus. The transfiguration created a bridge, a conduit, if you will, for the disciples. These days, we call places like this thin places, where the Creator and the creation touch one another. And the moment quickly dissipated. It's like trying to grab a snowflake in the warmth of your hand. It's gone before you get it. I've climbed a few mountains myself. Not too many snow-covered mountains, but I've climbed Mount Tabor, where tradition says the transfiguration might have happened. I studied on a mountain too, in Suwannee, which many people experience as a thin place. I'm sure many of you have mountaintop experiences in your lives, a place where God illumined something in you. Actually, one of my earliest enlightenment experiences in being in a thin place was not on a mountain, unless you call the banks of Clear Creek a kind of mountain. To a child, it can certainly seem like one. Most of the summers of my childhood and teen years I spent at Camp McDowell. I loved camp for so many reasons. Hiking over the swinging bridge, to go to St. Christopher's Pond, or walking up its banks to glide down the slippery wet rocks of Tillers. Later, we would pick the little leeches off of ourselves. Even that was kind of part of the experience. My first few years of camp were in the 70s, when people weren't so worried about liability, and we actually got to go rock climbing on those cliffs right there along Clear Creek. It was a cool experience. And one year at camp, I decided to sign up for the all-day-long canoe trip from below the dam at camp all the way to Smith Lake. And I came back proud of the blisters on my hands and so sunburnt that I couldn't sleep for 3 nights. I didn't sign up for that trip ever again. If you've ever been to Camp McDowell, you probably know you don't choose this camp for the activities, though. You don't choose it for the facilities either. Frankly, you could find other camps that have a whole lot more exciting things to do, horseback riding and zip lining and kayaking. What Camp McDowell offers, or at least what it offered to me, is an experience of living into myself as a child of God. It was a glimpse of the sacred, of living in community, a human community spirited by God. My mom and dad both loved and were wearied by my mountaintop experiences at Camp McDowell. They got rid of me for 1 or 2 weeks every summer, but they had to put up with the Camp McDowell blues for weeks after I came back from the camp. I clearly remember, and am a little embarrassed, I still have to say, about the many rides home from camp as I sat in the car with my mom, refusing to share about my experiences at camp. She'd never get it anyway. You had to be there. By the way, she was the one taking me away from all of this, away from all the things I shared at camp, the friends, the boyfriends, the long talks in small groups, the dancing, the singing, and the feeling that God is truly in this place. Camp transformed me. It allowed me to grow and be loved even when I wasn't deserving of it. I did not want to go back to the real world after camp, the world where people don't get it, where the love of Christ is misinterpreted as available only to certain people, or where Christ's love means obedience to archaic laws rather than about building what God intends for us, a loving, inclusive, healing community. But this is what we must do. We must walk down the mountain with Jesus, not as grumpy teens, but as people illumined by Christ's grace. Even in our broken selves, and perhaps particularly in our broken lives, we need to share that grace that we've known in all our holy experiences, in our experience with those who walk this journey alongside of us. It's only by sharing that we have a chance in this world for people to understand God's love. I wonder what Jesus, Peter, James, and John talked about as they left this special place. We know that Jesus said, "Don't tell anyone about the fact that I'm the Messiah." I wonder what they talked about. Or was it quiet? I picture the four friends walking down the mountain. In the words of a song I heard several years ago by a guy named Bebo Norman. It's a popular song. He said, "Walk down this mountain with your hearts held high. You've seen the very face of God." They would undoubtedly now follow Jesus, follow in the footsteps of their Creator who has touched them, and offer up their broken lives and taste the meaning of this life. Amen.